Hang on. I'm sure I remember her name. I'll say it wrongly. Colette, I think it's Abulka. I say the right. I will say Albuka. A B O U L K E R. A B O U L K E R. -MUSCAT. Muscat.
MUSCAT.
Albuka Muscat.
Cam for short.
Cam
for short.
Cam for short. Yeah. She really was the kind of woman you shortened her name. In fact, you called her Madame. Who actually, you know, it's a sort of that didn't really. She was very authoritarian. She's lovely, but she was very authoritarian,
Tell us just a wee bit about her.
I'm going to do it. I'm going to introduce her to you properly, really, because I've been bunging her in. So, but it's a sort of context in a sense, right? So with these Kabbalistic things, you get these very esoteric teachings. You get this Hasidic movement that has this power, but also kind of becomes very kind of authoritarian, and. In a sense, you get a sort of, in the 19th century in Europe, a flowering around the Kabbalah that starts to arise out of theosophy. And women, interestingly, women become very important in this, because in the 19th century, you get this great movement called theosophy, initiated by a woman called Madame Blavatsky. And there's various people who helped. Another woman who helped her was Annie Besant, and the various men that helped as well, but
Leonard somebody or other
could be. I don't know all the names of theosophists, but what's interesting is you get this kind of generic esoteric kind of movement that's linked to spiritualism, because the other thing that happens is you get spiritualism rising as a cultural movement in the 19th century, again mostly led by women. So you get this kind of really interesting thing that starts to happen, is you get this movement. The spiritualism is this very kind of interesting but powerful kind of movement that kind of sweeps Victorian society, and it's mostly women at the heart of it. Women acting as mediums between the living and the dead. And controversial subjects, all kinds of issues about it, but it starts to condition a new form of spirituality in the West, and it's combined with then the Theosophical Society, which kind of rode on its coattails, really, because it was a spiritualism by far the bigger movement. Then creates a kind of climate where people are sort of breaking away from conventional kind of religion. And we get these various esoteric societies being formed, like the Order of the Golden Dawn, later the Society of the Inner Light, that are taking these old Kabbalistic teachings and working with powerful archetypal imagery. But they're doing it still in a very very patriarchal, very masculine way. The Golden Dawn founders were all Masons, and so they created their spiritual structures were all based upon Masonic kind of lines. Simultaneously, as you get this movement in the 19th century coming into the 20th century in Jewish circles, where the Kabbalah starts to be rediscovered, gets linked in with some of the Zionist movements that are about trying to establish a homeland in Israel. And what you see starting to happen is the various ways of looking at the imagination and working with the imagination that have been held in esoteric circles starting to emerge out of the shadows. And one of the really, when I was young, when I was 18, which would be back then in 73, there was this thing that people were talking about called path working, which was very secret and very powerful, and you didn't really, initially didn't know what it was even, because people wouldn't tell you what it was. But actually, it was the disciplined work with the creative, with the embodied imagination. So it was regarded as quite kind of a bit dangerous, a bit secret, and needing to be controlled in a very kind of particular way. Now, one of the features of a lot of these teachings is that they're presented in quite a complicated way. They're hierarchical, so you've got these various grades of initiation and things you learn and practices that you learn, and monstrously complicated books. And in some ways, the pre-Hasidic Kabbalah reasserts itself as a sort of elite practice for very cognitive men. I mean, the rule around the early Kabbalah was that it could only be studied by men, and men over 40 who had fathered children. Wow, bizarre. Although one of the greatest ever medieval Kabbalists, the Ari, who was a sort of great Kabbalist of Zavat in Israel, was only 30 and wasn't married when he went, but still he was regarded as a special case. So what you find are these very powerful spiritual teachings, but very embedded in a patriarchal framework. But then you get people, well, interestingly, you get people like Dion Fortune appear. So our local celebrity, Dion Fortune, who is this really creative, very interesting woman, who picks up these ancient teachings, both from the past and the teachings presented to her by the Order of the Golden Dawn, and starts to embody them, starts to do something different with them. Now, she's a woman of her time, you know, she's dead by 47, so you know, she's born in 1890, so she's, you know, she didn't quite reach 60, really. Died of leukemia. But she does this interesting thing of writing this book called The Mystical Kabbalah, and offshoots of that, and then writes these very powerful imagistic novels based on the Kabbalah. That my good friend and I have commented on in some detail. I won't do that. And she creates this sort of formula of putting together the novels with the theory of the Tree of Life, and then gives this hint about the body and the Holy Spirit being in the body. That actually is a formula for the embodiment of the creative imagination. And she creates this very small, at that time, very small organization called the Society of the Inner Light, which for a little while is very creative. During the war years, she does something that's never been done before. She sends out letters giving instructions about working with the body and the imagination to work with the collective soul of the country. Sends those out to anybody who wants them. You know, she's a genuine visionary in that sense. And one of the things Penny and I were talking about this over lunch. One of the things that happens at the end, as she dies, is the person who takes over her organization, trained by Jesuits. There's nothing wrong about being trained by Jesuits, John. But a man called Arthur Chichester decides to get rid of any mention of Dion Fortune at all. Or they destroy loads of archival information, destroy photographs of her, because he believes that there is that that an archetypal female image has been created, which is dominating the fraternity and leading people into barred ways. And she writes two books, one book called Sea Priestess, the other one called Moon Magic, in which she talks about a very powerful figure called variously Vivien Le Fay and later Lilith Le Fay. There is this very powerful archetype of the dark feminine, of the creative feminine. Never forgotten, maybe the first time I read those books, they were so exciting, so powerful. And the other book, novels are powerful as well, but these two in particular, because they're speaking, I think, of the need of the emergence of an archetype that has been long dispossessed and sent away. And it's a bit topical. This, and Penny and I are actually writing an article about it at the moment, because the Inner Light have just published a magazine. They have this house magazine, where there's four articles have been written saying how this figure of Lilith Le Fay is this dangerous, dark, disturbing figure, and who people should stay away from and will destroy, will be destructive to people and send them mad and kind of and all the rest of it. And prior to, periodically this seems to happen in relationship to this archetype, and I think it's essentially patriarchy and misogyny. Because back in the early 80s, Geico writes under the pseudonym of Gareth Knight, whose real name is Basil Wilby. He ran his own occult group, and he had a magazine called Quadriga. Wrote this long article about how he banished this figure of Lilith Le Fay, who kept coming back and obsessing people. And and the sort of myth has been created that's just been reinforced by this this latest set of articles about the dangerous dark feminine archetype that has to be banished and kept away. And we'll get into all the details. Some of the things in the article are ludicrous. I mean, it's sort of one of the writers claims that he did something to do with the Sea Priestess on Breen Down, which is where that book is set out. And then 2 years later, he had a flat tire, which was the vengeance of the Sea Priestess, which is kind of, so it's a bit, some of it's a bit barking, right? But there's a sort of edge in all of this where it kind of shows that the roots of misogyny and the fear of the feminine.
This is Lillian in the Arches. Does anyone listen to the Arches?
I don't, I'm sorry, no. So
that's not good. If I say anybody doesn't listen to the Arches.
Well, no, Penny does, so Penny would know.
Who's Lillian? That one at coffee break. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm with you, yeah.
But the thing is that the whole, one of the really powerful things about what we're looking at in terms of this working with the deep imagination, it is a descent into the underworld. It is a descent into the presence of the divine feminine. And in a way, a lot of these issues that we were talking about before lunch, about the sort of the demonization of sexuality, the fear of the body, the fear of matter, it are all a kind of associated with the splitting away from the divine feminine and the sacralizing of the masculine, and particularly the masculine intellect.
What did you say
about
the splitting away of the masculine?
Well, and the sort of sacralizing of the masculine and in particular the masculine intellect. Okay. Right, so and there's something about that, the splitting away of that. And it's where you get the God the Father image, not God the Mother, or whatever. You know, this is a very deep cultural, very deep kind of cultural thing that keeps on repeating itself. Even in places where you think they would know better. So, in the Society of the Inner Light has this very powerful, very charismatic female teacher. And the next thing that happens is everything about her is, if I can't think of a single male teacher that has happened to. You know, it's a sort of, and there's another weird kind of thing that happens around Beryl and Fortune, is that people periodically give lectures or write things about her, sort of similar, therefore in a way riding off her reputation, working with her reputation, but then being immensely critical of her simultaneously. And it's only men doing this, a sort of, you know, that so there's something about the attacks upon the woman teacher.
Wikipedia, I read it this morning,
yeah,
about her biography. I suppose it really ramped up the kind of falling out of other with her and other people, and then it talked about the mistrust of the cult of the personality. So it was interesting, it was kind of going, well, this is quite neutral, but actually there was a cult of personality around the unfortunate. So again, it felt like it was undermining her.
Yeah, totally, yeah.
Yeah, but in a very objective way.
Yeah.
But when you think of how few people knew about the unfortunate and how many people knew about Alistair Crowe.
Oh,
yeah,
it's astonishing, the different ways the sexes are treated.
Well, it does, and actually the cult of personality, she didn't do very well at the cult of personality if that was the case, because hardly anybody knew about her. And my own teacher, Ernest, absolutely knew her, and of course was a student, and didn't have that opinion of her. You know, he never said very much about her, but he really respected her. And
it was talking about justifying why the archive was destroyed.
Yes, that's right.
Because they thought that actually it wasn't useful, this following the cult of the unfortunate. So it justified it.
And it's kind of interesting, because if that had been a creative act, if that had been something that needed, then one would have expected the SIL to be this very creative, productive organisation subsequently. And they haven't been. They've been absolutely moribund. This kind of, you know, they're being a bit more active again now. But they're in a sense, there's no, on their part, no advance beyond, in fact, a retreat really from back into older forms. So there's something about one of the issues that we are constantly looking at in our subject is this misogynist, patriarchal, authoritarian way of looking at the world, which of course is kind of having a heyday again at the moment with the rise of authoritarian politicians and charismatic politicians who are calling on these kind of these ancient archetypes of manhood, you know, the kind of the and so there's a sort of so inevitably when we look at this, we engage with these things, we meet these distortions. And so images of, you know, we encounter the future and the androgynous winged human being, or the, which is looking at something beyond, into the new, beyond the old certainties, the old split polarities. We're looking at something quite important, I think.
Didn't it happen with Hatshepsut as well?
Yes, it did. Yes, it did. Temples
and things were defaced.
The temples were defaced, absolutely, no.
The beard on her.
Mm. Well, no, she put a beard on herself.
That's true.
No, they hacked the beard off her is the most significant thing, because the beard is the determination of being pharaoh. So she, you know, they took away. So this is a very ancient tendency in human nature. You know, and kind of, and periodically you get these very charismatic, powerful kind of women teachers, rulers who try and be different. I don't know if anybody's been watching. There's a program on Friday night called Jamestown, which is about the founding of the community of Virginia, first community of Virginia. And there's a character in there called Jocelyn, who's a woman who is a widow, but determined to be independent and not to be married. And they and it's historically accurate, this probe. The women, if they widows, couldn't remain widows in the colonies. If they did, they were regarded as dangerous sexual beings who had, were publicly shamed by the community.
Leather menstrue
would disturb families, would destroy the destroy the harmony of the colony, and needed to be. But of course, the particularly dangerous because they are independent. They haven't got a man there telling them what to do, to whom they are subservient. So there's something very kind of threatening about that idea, right? So this, and there's all there's lots of layers in this around social history and sort of, but. Well, one of the kind of key things that's in there somewhere is the fear of femininity, the fear of that the root of life.
And the need to control
it, exactly. You can't do without it, right? You can't do without it. Have to have it. But then if you have to have it, you have to control it. Which is where we end up with the Hasidim, with shaving women's heads, kind of restricting them what they can do, what they should do. The, you know, you get work all the time, support the men. Men are doing the important stuff.
That's why there's so many gynecologists that are men.
Yes. Exactly. It's very strange. Whereas, what would when we start to look at working with the deep imagination, we are reversing all of that. Whether we're man or woman, if we're going to engage with this at all, as we have been, we have to come into the body, we have to come into the senses, we have to come into mystery, we have to become passive and responsive. We have to be able to be with mystery. We have to give birth. In a sense, we have to be impregnated with mystery and give birth. Whatever our sex.
I'm struggling to understand what the fear is or what the wound is with patriarchal, misogynistic. What is so frightening? What is so wounding?
So, well, there's obviously a lot, I think there's probably a lot of answers to that, but
probably a really naive question.
No, it's a good question. It is a good question because it gets us to think again, right? It's to really think. Well, okay. So, what do we think? What do we think the wound is?
Well, nature was very frightening to us in our early development. We could be wiped out by it.
Mm.
So, at some point, we experienced the more negative side of the goddess rather than the positive side. I think it's sort of, as we evolved, our ego wanted to control
It's a fear of feeling.
Yeah, but it's sort of wanting to control nature. I'm fighting for that connection with the feminine, because it was the goddess that represented nature.
Mm.
Before the patriarchy came in, it was a culture of the goddess, and the goddess represented nature. And birth and destruction, and mothers actually hold that. Women giving birth, they were part of that. We are part of it. Giving birth, we can also destroy. Mothers can be incredibly powerful and frightening.
The bleeding of women as well. It's like a kind of a marking that there's something that. Something abhorrent and an aberration of nature, the kind of the almost like death in life, that you're still alive but you're bleeding.
Mm. And as you take that back to the mikveh, and that you have to menstruate and you have to go and be cleansed before you can have contact again with society.
Mm.
Churching women after childbirth.
Mm.
But what you see is what you get with a man, but with women on. Everything's sort of inside, isn't it?
It's fear of coming into the body and feeling.
Yes.
It's a fear of feeling all the pains.
Yes.
Much easier to be in control and rationalise everything.
Mm.
Much safer.
Yes.
But it's not coming into the heart.
Yeah. phenomenal healing, you know.
You couldn't have war if you stayed in the heart, could you? Because you'd be appalled at what was happening.
Well, with the basic sex organs, you know, women are, everything about women is concealed and mysterious, isn't it?
Mm.
Mm. And medicine is,
I suppose it goes back to the temptress, Eden, you know, devious by nature.
Mm.
It goes back to that very primeval pattern.
The banishing from the garden.
Yeah,
I can't just come back to that. Banishing Eden.
I just keep going back to it. Men have to put an incredibly vulnerable bit of themselves somewhere that they don't really understand.
Isn't there a big thing about vaginas with teeth? Yes, that's right. Vagina dentata.
That makes sense, but I'm guessing it might go back early, and because I'm in a room full of psychologists and I'm not, but I just think, well, like, all children are bossed around by their mothers and tell them what to do and what not to do, you know, just to keep them safe, and there's a point at which they... So the mothers are basically all powerful, so at some point you sort of kind of rebel against that and think, well, they'll never, they must be kept down, or because they are way too powerful, because everybody would be at that stage where, you know, the mother is all powerful.
Especially if she's Welsh.
I don't know, I kind of think that, it's interesting, I'm sitting below the alien, because that's kind of in my head. But my sense, so at lunchtime I learned a very interesting fact about the future, which is our data storage will soon be stored in DNA.
Yeah.
That was very interesting. So I'm wondering if our fear is actually that there will be no male or female.
Yes, that's right.
Fear is that we will become this.
Yeah.
So we'll become a blended being. Because I find being around a lot of women, they don't see themselves as wanting to become to a place where they become equal. They actually want the power, which I find quite interesting.
Yep.
Whereas I always strive for equalness. I always strive for that kind of bit of the middle, never to become more potent than, or bigger than, or more important than. And I think that this would be an immersion of the two together. So perhaps it's the fear of that.
So it's the mantra of the women's movement was equal but different. I was thinking as well about egg and sperm, about the vagina dentata, in a way, I suppose, that the sperm is, in a way, destroyed.
Yep.
The head explodes.
Yeah, that's right.
The egg is much bigger as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
The sperm is, on that point of conception, then the head disintegrates.
And millions of us become just die.
Yeah.
A horrible death.
But there's only one egg, but there's millions of sperms.
Mm-hmm. The unfortunate thing is that the thing about Christianity is unbalanced is that it sees as these polarised positions that are continuously in opposition instead of being in a fluid, harmonious relationship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
Well, of course, you know, one might not be dominant but take precedence at one part of life and then another. It's no big deal. It's like opening the door for a man who's got loads of parcels. It's not a big deal. It's a common courtesy, you know, for a human being.
Yeah.
So it's a power struggle.
It's always been presented as a power struggle, hasn't it? You just look at a 1950s film, you know, after the Second World War when all the women were working, and suddenly it's Doris Day sex comedies. The war of the sexes, get back in the kitchen, you know.
I saw an interesting thing on wildlife program recently, which is that reindeer, the female reindeer she has antlers, and the male loses them. And it's so they use the antlers to clear the snow so that the calves can feed on the grass. And by the male losing his antlers, the female then can see him off, and he loses his prestige outside the rutting season, so that she can clear the ground for the calf to feed, and the male can't push his way in there. So it's quite an interesting balance, which is the opposite of like with red deer. The precedence then is given to the calf. That's what happens in there.
I think it's a really ancient thing that we've been doing it for so long. It's embedded within us that this happened, as it were.
It's really difficult to erase. There's a program on Netflix, don't know if anyone's seen that, The Ascent of Woman. It's, I can't remember who it was. But if anyone does have Netflix, it's an amazing program, four programs, and actually looking at the disappearance of the female from history,
yeah.
And all of the different practices in many, many different countries, and then looking at historically significant women that have actually, in a way, been more powerful than the cultural norm, and then what happened subsequently. And also, I suppose what she was talking about is often where there have been women who have been leaders, they have actually increased, I suppose, equality, and which then after that female leader has died, there's been almost a backlash.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Mm.
And she looked at Africa, Asia,
yeah,
all over the world. Can't remember her name, but it's an amazing program series.
I wanted to pick up on what Andrea was saying about it being ancient. It's so far, far back that it's hard to imagine what it could have been. One of the puzzles for me is how it was allowed to happen, because it doesn't make sense.
Do you think it was just through physicality that...
I can't be convinced. I mean, I've read all the accounts of how it happened.
Mm.
I don't find any of them convincing.
Mm. No, I'm not convinced. Isn't it a simple thing that when we were gatherer hunters, people lived harmoniously in the land, you know, doing lots of... As soon as you become agrarian and you get territory and you have to defend your territory and you have to, you know, and life becomes more of a formula, really.
Okay.
And then you get possessions.
That's one paradigm theory.
Mm.
And it's an interesting story, but it doesn't convince me. It didn't have to happen that way. And I don't understand why it did, if it did. I don't find any explanations for how it's come to be make any sense at all.
I heard
there's
once,
no reason for it.
I heard once that women, as it were in charge. The goddess culture was the one that was here. And it oppressed men.
Possibly, yeah.
And then it's flipped to the other way around.
I can see the cycle, a cycle happening, but we're a long way into this particular aspect of the cycle, which may be swinging round, but the cycle has been one-sided for so many thousands of years, and explanations are given which are kind of a circular argument, it happened because it happened. But it seems so way back, we're disconnected from what started it, because there's no reason why it should be as it is.
I was thinking of that fear of merging with other, and being that fear of merging with a woman. It was terrifying for me. And I had that experience when I had that relationship with women. It is. You know, you're sort of like, oh my God, is this what men kind of feel like? You know, sort of like that merging with a woman, you know, sort of making love with a woman can be very terrifying. You know, it's sort of like it's very prime merging with a woman, and trying to keep a sense of yourself in that relationship. And finding a way of, yes, I want to merge, I want to, but no, I don't want to. It's sort of like that kind of wanting to come out of relationship, and how do you stay separate? That kind of battle between yearning, you know, letting your passions come out and becoming, merging with the other, and then wanting to come back out and be separate. With, you know, sort of finding that way where the passions don't dominate you, where you can actually learn how to ride them and stay separate. That's what I'm dealing with at the moment, you know, just being with that place. And learning how to be with the passions and desire, riding them, evolving with them, rather than them dominate you. Or be dominant, or feel as if they're dominating you. And I think what happens for men is that fear of losing their sense of self, so they will go and dominate others.
Well, that
the woman, or vice versa, you know.
That's an idea that is a possibility. On the other hand, there may be many men who are delighted to be at one with woman.
Mm-hmm. Can they sustain it though?
There are many men who can quite possibly sustain it.
Why would, if they're happy with it, why then that's sustainable, isn't it? I'm more interested in this society thing to start off with. It seems to me that my original gatherer hunter thing had components which were the jobs were divided between the genders and were of equal worth. So were recognised as such. So first of all, you didn't have this huge conglomeration of men and women all mixing together all the time. There was a natural separation for a lot of the time.
But okay. I take that as a general rule.
Yeah.
The exception, Scathlach. Who was a woman warrior, Scottish or Irish, who trained Cathulain. Trained all the Irish heroes.
But that was
normal.
But most tribal societies, who often you see have these strict divisions, that always have this interim bit that allows people to be themselves.
Okay, but why is it the norm, that division?
Because men are stronger and have more stamina for hunting. I don't know why. Physiological things, I've no idea.
Look at all the women huntresses.
Yep.
Sorry, I'm not... But, sorry, that's a bit rude.
Of course it was. No, they didn't have lots of babies and be great huntresses. You know, there's a sort of division. There are physical functions that mean women tend to be sort of pack people.
I don't get it at all.
I suppose there could be a societal, you know, an interest in societal stories, whether it's hunter-gatherer or the agrarian, and that's a big shift, and then the rise of private property, and then the competition for resources. And I suppose then other tribes kind of coming in, and how is the tribe protected if perhaps women are looking after children or birthing children, and what happens when a marauding tribe comes in, how is that protected? So, and also the biological, I was just thinking then about going, God, you know, to have an erection, I mean, I know you can have an erection in the presence of another man, because if you're turned on by a man, then you'll have erection. But in a way, to have a part of your body just going whoop in the presence of a female must feel like, my God, that's black magic. What are you doing to me? Whereas, in a way, a woman's sexuality isn't.
Hang on.
I love that.
I don't know. So it's a wondering.
I'm like, what? So maybe
you are kind of getting back into some kind of archetypal pictures almost of going, you know, woman, what are you doing to my body? And it's you who are doing
it. You could argue there is an image there. I will magic a response that will praise the image.
Yes, there could be. And also, I suppose, I was thinking, God, that must be quite frightening to be kind of going, oh, what's happening with my body because of you who have done this to me? Whereas a woman getting turned on, it is inside.
Yeah, it's private.
And actually, it's not necessarily seen by others. No, it feels preposterous in one way, but...
Yeah. It's the need for dominance and control. And I'm trying to get back to, I think back to tribal places where there might have been equal respect and no societal need for dominance. Although I'm sure in family groups, you've got men who are pigs and women who are horrible, and you know, they, you'd have all those normal social interactions. But as a societal thing, the idea of one gender sex keeping the other down, you know.
I just seen a film called Tyway. Something like T-A-W-A-I-I. Anyway, he does tribal, there's little indigenous populations, in villages and so on. He goes and lives there for a month. Bruce, somebody or other. He goes to South America, and there's no hierarchy in this. So everybody's equal. But they don't have any possessions. They don't have material goods, so they're not trying to accumulate, they're just living. They're just going out in the forest and getting their food. So it's a very different world than we live in today, which is, I've got to defend my patch, I've got to... There's a hierarchy, we're going to the moon, you know.
Devaluing of roles is such a big thing as well, isn't it? You know, as though working for an insurance company and spending all day on a computer is somehow a significantly better, more exciting thing that everybody would want to do. And where's meaning in the roles as well?
I'm also interested in archetypes, because we're talking about roles and things like that, but I guess I'm confused, and I guess I'm kind of interested in archetypes somewhere, because they set a tone, don't they? They set, this is what you're supposed to be doing, or this is who you're being, this archetype, or you know. I get really confused by, you know, male, female archetypes sometimes, because sometimes you might have a warrior woman, you might have a birthing woman, you might have a particularly feminine woman, you might have a really feminine man.
Yeah.
Male archetypes, you know, is it simply that we've just split those? Is it simply that we want particular archetypes to be woman, or we want particular archetypes to be man? What is the reason that we would put all of that demonic kind of stuff onto women and inside that patriarchal society, or take it all away from men? You know, when we talk about the splitting of women, demonising women and sexualising that male intellect, we're not just talking about doing that as a man or a woman, like, you know, sexualising our own intellect and calling that the male part of us.
Yeah.
You know, what is it? I still don't get, oh yeah, that makes sense, I understand the reason that that's happened.
Can I respond to that? If you take the example of Loki from the Northern European tradition, he's both male and female. Mm-hmm. He's a chaotic figure. Yeah. He's neither man nor woman. Mm-hmm. He acts as both man and woman. He transforms continually. You don't know what he, she is at any particular time. It's a very powerful figure in Northern European mythology, an essential figure, a central pivot for everything. Mm. And that's what I try and get back to, that chaotic figure that brings together every aspect of personality, sexuality, gender, in a constant flux. Mm. And Loki is the most dangerous, feared mythic figure there is, I think. Possibly there are others in a similar blend, but it's that kind of combination of chaos which I think is most feared, and which people try and define and fix into a particular form that's safe. rather than go in with a constant flux. That's just an ongoing idea I have about it.
And still, why I really, you know, this kind of, I like talking about this, but there's something about it's almost accepted, and actually when we all talk about it, there's a real kind of digging into it as well, which I'm enjoying. But this splitting, and then either glorifying or denigrating one sex, that's the thing that I even though there is a story of this or a story of this or a story of this, I think, you know, like you, you know, kind of going, actually I still don't understand, really.
Yeah.
The Madonna whore, and that happens to one side of the equation, not the other. Even though we have this spectrum in each of us.
Maybe my son have got closest to it. Maybe it's because the woman is the ultimate power figure for the growing child.
What happens if we find within us both archetypes?
That's right.
I mean, literally, if you just feel into the male and the femaleness in yourself now, what happens to you?
I think there's a sense of completion. Mm. There is for me, anyway.
Get bigger.
Potential and possibility.
Sense of rightness.
A relief, because it's much easier to stay in the rational, busy mind, and the coming into myself is a relief when I come into the more feminine.
I find it's a relief when I come into the masculine.
I think the terms masculine and feminine are incredibly unhelpful.
Fluid,
we've been, you know, been searching for many years. So I suppose there's yin and yang, you know, and stuff, but to find words that are for complementary forces that are not related to gender, there just aren't any in our culture. And this masculine and feminine things.
But isn't there a difference between man and woman? And masculine and feminine. There is for me, that's what I think of it anyway.
Yeah.
So you can have both masculine and feminine qualities in all of us, which I think we have.
Hmm.
But I'm a woman. I have the woman's bits anyway. So I'm a woman. It's more complicated. But that helps us to keep that separate. I don't know if that's useful or not.
Yes, but to call someone a feminine man or a masculine woman or whatever, you just think people just have different qualities. The fact is, we've assigned some of them to gender, and it's really not helpful anymore.
But if you think about fixed and fluid, okay, we might have different bits that are fixed, but within that body frame, there is great fluidity, and it's that fluidity that's constrained for some reason that restricts us to our disadvantage, I think.
So how comfortable do people feel with their fluidity?
So I was just sitting with myself, and I notice sometimes I might want to orchestrate myself in one direction and maybe disown other parts of myself.
Yeah.
So I guess we choose our stronger parts because that's who we are as human beings. Is that what it is?
Well, I guess that's perhaps what happens, and I think the problem with that is then there's another part that's always looking, is trying to live, which we have to do something with. And I think, you know, fundamentally, you know, we have to be all of who we are.
Yeah.
You know, but that, I think it's hard. I mean, I think, you know, we take ideas like fluidity seriously. They are quite disturbing. Because they start to take us, and in a way it's interesting, you know, we're talking about this very complicated issue, but there's a certain point where the conversation runs out and we're with not knowing, we're with the kind of the mystery of something, how the hell did we get here and why, what is this, and kind of, and how do we do this, how do we be this, and in a way that's it takes us into a sort of a mystery that disturbs us. And it takes us into a sort of, you know, it takes us into this impossible images, really. I mean, it's like we get to Tochlechte, is an image of being shrouded in death at his mother's breast. Now, that's an image, extraordinary image of a baby in a shroud suckling.
Is there an explanation for why that is the case? Why he's shrouded in death? It's just given as that is the case.
Well, it's given that that's the case, but the sort of explanation in terms of the large, in terms of I've been calling him Fenechti, which is wrong. So I've been doing, it's actually, because it's Fenechti, I think. Hang on a minute. I'm going to stop saying his name actually because it's stopping me talking about it, but he is the figure in the dialogue of the two sages that is the older poet who is able to be with death and life. And is able to be, and so that very powerful image of the baby suckling shrouded in death, who can be the baby. In some ways, he can, Neve, in the Dialogue of the Two Sages, is all about light, goodness, newness, possibility, kind of. But what he doesn't have, he gives the good news, but he doesn't have the terrible news that Fenechti is able to produce. Because there's something about his image of being the baby shrouded in death, suckling from the mother. Not hidden from the mother, not hidden from death.
And of course that's true, isn't it?
Yeah.
The minute you're born,
it's real.
But also, it strikes me, if you take the metaphor further, that he's someone who can die to being man to become woman, can die to being woman to become man. His fluidity, in that sense, is part of who he is.
Yes, exactly.
He, she,
whatever, exactly. And the sort of, and so that he does not resist his own fluidity. Mm. And of course, that's the issue behind all of this, and behind all of what we do, is what, you know, principally all we ever do here is get present and then respond to what emerges, whether it's coming out of me or you or anybody else, right? So it's, and in that we have to embody, well, we have to choose to embody or to not embody whatever is emerging. Which means we have to cooperate or not cooperate, to say yes or no to whatever is trying to emerge. The difference between Fochetne and Neve is that what Neve allows to emerge is the good. But what he cannot allow to emerge so easily is the destructive energies. So Fochetne is in a way much more like you describe Loki, this much more kind of chaotic but creative figure that generates life around themselves and cannot easily be put in a box. And in a sense, when we come into our senses, we come into presence, we come then into that generative capacity of our own hearts. That brings life, but also creates chaos. One of the things I put on the board right at the beginning of the weekend, which isn't there now, is it was a comment from Alistair Crowley. his idea, who was a 19th, early 20th century occultist, who said, every man and woman is a star. It's kind of interesting in common, in just in terms of where we are culturally at the moment, because sometimes seems like every man and woman wants to be a star in the in the celebrity sense of the word. But he, of course, wasn't using it in that connection. He's using it as a literal image of every human being has this generative potential, as a star does, to create, and therefore has the kind of that is potentially generating all the time. Light and life, which can nourish or can destroy.
And Nietzsche said, "You must have chaos in you to give birth to a dancing
star." That's right. Nietzsche absolutely said that. Says that at the
kind of reference.
Yeah, exactly. He was that, and consciously or consciously referencing. So that kind of Aleister Crowley himself actually is bisexual, is all kinds of things, right? Sort of, so he is very, in a way, you could say he's a contemporary Loki figure from that point of view.
You know, if you take Loki as a role model, then you have to consider copulating with a giant to produce a six-legged horse.
Mm.
Now, are you up for that?
But the interesting thing about the stories of Loki, the sense you get of Loki in the stories is he bounces from one thing to another thing. You know, he's not there's something about this aspect of human nature, this perpetually creative, chaotic aspect of human nature, that is perpetually challenging. And keeps we can talk about deconstructing society, but of course it can do. But there's this dialogue almost between this creative deconstruction and the need for construction and safety, and the balance between these two places determines really how things go. But I guess in our time at least, the scales are shifted in the direction of safety and of containment and of control.
Well, that's because, isn't it, that we mentioned an age of individuation that is quite scary to governments. Because if you think back 40 years, society was so regimented and your role in society was so regimented that no one would deviate from it. Now, every individual has a right to be whatever they are, do you see what I mean?
Yeah, no, obviously the things have changed.
When there was security of job, a man would go to a factory job at 14 and leave it at 60 and die 3 years later. And then that happened to generations of people.
Yeah, sure.
A woman would marry him at 18 and go into the home, and that's it. That's the society that we sprang from. And when you look at what's happening today, it's no wonder society's trying to get a handle on this.
The curious thing is, the society that you describe like that is barely 200 years old.
Yes, that's true.
The human condition has been going on for thousands and thousands of years.
Of course, this is the aberration, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is the blink.
Yes. But it's the blink that I know about, that I lived through,
But that's what I'm going back to say. To encounter the mindset where things were very, very different is so very, very hard.
It is, actually.
That's exactly right, and it's why people do things like reaching back to ancient cultures, reaching into tribal cultures, in order to try and almost evade the inevitable collision, chaotic collision of the problem that we can't get our heads around, can't find a way through. Because actually the whole point about what we're looking at here, and when anyone looks at deep creativity, is that you work with what you get, with what presents itself to you, inwardly or outwardly. So the attempt to go somewhere else, to run off to tribal societies or to run into the past, what that does in the end is to create a little cul-de-sac that maybe keeps you safe for a while, but doesn't really solve anything.
think it's a valiant attempt to try and get out of thinking of the present paradigm. Though.
It's an attempt to, but its problem is that instead of staying with the confusion, it simplifies and creates a new split, right? Yeah. So if I'm kind of being Anglo-Saxon worshipper of Loki or Celtic servant of the Morrigan, I'm just creating another little world.
Yeah.
You know, I'm wrong. I'm not saying that's wrong, but I think it doesn't solve that problem of what is going on for us and how can we move beyond the place that we find ourselves.
Do you think that if we drop the word gender, that is, Penny's having a baby, and I said, "Oh, what do you know? It's sex." And she said, "No, it's a human being.
It's a baby." It's yeah, slightly.
Right, okay, but I just noticed that's she's 40 now. So I just think the young people may have, people in their 40s, but they may bring a completely different paradigm around.
Well, I think that's part of what we're starting to see in movies. When it's complicated, I don't want to get into all the details there because that's a whole other discussion. But you can start to see something else starting to work its way through there in some ways.
But this is a bit belated. You said about male and female. I think, but I am not. No, I'm sort of post-sexual. This is great. I'm not wise. But I'm more creative than I've ever been. I think somebody is a well-known phrase, unchained from a lunatic. And it's sort of like the time I wasted, sort of like doing my head in a terrible moment. Like, my God, it's all over. And so I kind of relate to being a child. And that and C.S. Lewis and the Narnia, and Philip Pullman is really condescending about that because he didn't recognise that they were going to be adolescents and he was down on children's sexuality. But I remember childhood as being childhood as being very vivid, and then I gave up all things that now I think are really interesting again, to hang around bus stations, appropriate lights. And I think, I was mad! So I now regard that sort of stage of my life as a complete, aberration. I'm going back to being ephemeris and things what I thought were important when I was 10. And I'm not quite sure what the point was.
Well, you're moving beyond definition. You're moving beyond that
gender, and from kind of being in a sort of state from outside of that. Okay,
being much more.
I suppose they must think they're male, female, mixed. Okay, or less. Anyway, it's just throw the train that in.
No, I think what you're describing is going beyond a particular definition and moving on to a different stage in your life that releases your creativity differently, I think. I think that's really important.
And being beyond society's expectations of you.
Yes, exactly.
As a woman or man of a certain age for a certain role. Mm. Whereas actually they leave you alone when you get older.
Mm.
It's one thing about the invisibility of age.
I love not having to try and live up to somebody else's standards of everything. It's such a reclaiming of time and energy that you can actually use for more more useful things and more interesting things. Gaining wisdom and not being one of them.
I'm going to stop in a second for a cup of tea, but I just want to pose this question, really, in terms of what we've been looking at this weekend is, if you like, a paradigm shift in terms of the Hasidim that failed. And I don't want to get into speculating how could we culturally do that, because that isn't that the whole point about the paradigm shift that the Baal Shem Tov and such people created was it was personal. It was person to person, person on person. So if we think for ourselves for a moment about the paradigm shift, the possible paradigm shift that faces us in deepening into this work of working with a deep imagination, stepping beyond, if you like, our current definitions, if we think of that, a step of doing that, what happens to us? Just in ourselves, not the grand plans about society, but just in ourselves, if we think about taking a step that would shift our internal paradigm in this way. So, let's have a quick cup of tea while we're thinking about that.